From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. North Carolina's House District 20 has new boundaries in time for the 2020 elections. What used to be a district that included most of northern New Hanover County is now a smaller area. It no longer includes Curie Beach or Carolina Beach, but it still has Wrightsville Beach and now also covers Landfall, Porter's Neck, Figure Eight Island, and the Holly Tree, Masonboro Loop, and Monkey Junction areas. Representative Holly Grange has been the 2.5-term incumbent in District 20, but she announced her run for governor, which took her out of the race for state house. Because of the redrawn boundaries, both Representatives Grange and Ted Davis Jr. now live in District 20. Ted Davis Jr. has represented House District 19 since 2012. Since his appointment in September of that year, he was elected to the seat 2 months later, and he's won re-election 3 times. He's now seeking a 5th term as the representative of District 20. Before his time in the State House, Representative Davis served as an assistant New Hanover County attorney, assistant state district attorney, and assistant United States attorney before opening his own law practice in 1984. Representative Davis served on the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners from 1996 to 2008. He is currently the senior chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He serves as chair of the Committee on Appropriations, Justice, and Public Safety, and he is vice chair of 4 committees. He joins me now. Representative Ted Davis, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. I appreciate you letting me be here.
Good to have you here. Why do you want this job again?
Rachel, I like helping people. One of the biggest thrills of my life is when I'm able to have someone ask me to see if I can do something, and I'm able to go to Raleigh and get it done. And I want to keep on doing that. I want to represent my constituents the best that I can, and I want to try to help them every way that I can. That's what it's about for me.
Now, we talked about double bunking and Representative Holly Grange and you winding up in the same district when the maps were redrawn. Can you kind of explain how that works and what that means and why Holly Grange is no longer going to be the representative in this district?
Certainly. When the redistricting was done, and what was actually done with the redistricting was to try to come up with districts that had equal population. So in order to do that, the present District 20 as well as the present District 19 had to change. So what you saw with my present District 19 was that it was smaller as far as New Hanover County, but it took on the southern part of Brunswick County across the river. Then what happened in District 20, when that was redrawn, Holly Grange and I both resided there. It's called double bunking. Obviously, you can't have 2 representatives, you know, living in the same district. So what happened was that a choice had to be made. I could have gone and said, okay, can we try to redraw the district so that I can remain in District 19 and run there? Or do I just keep it the way it is and see if I'm going to be the only one living in District 20 that would be eligible to run? That happened and took care of itself when Holly Grange announced that she was running for governor. That put her out of the running for the House, put me in, and that's why I'm the incumbent living in the new District 20 and running for re-election there.
So you've served for quite a while now, but when you think about 2020, what do you think the single most important issue facing District 20 is?
Well, there are various issues that are important to District 20. Of course, right now, COVID-19 is an extremely important issue because it influences so many different things. So I know that I'm very proud with the fact that when the COVID-19 epidemic started, that in Raleigh, we ended up appropriating over $3 billion in COVID relief to try to help people in the different aspects that were affected by the coronavirus. So I certainly see that as something that we must continue to do because I don't know when it's going to go away. I hope it will one day, but I don't know when. So I think once again, the coronavirus and all of the things that it affects is certainly the most important thing I see going forward.
And in some ways, passing relief both on Capitol Hill and in Raleigh were, you know, the idea of that was nonpartisan. Everybody understood that businesses and organizations and people, individuals and families needed help. But still, in other ways, the coronavirus turned political. There are critics of Governor Roy Cooper's executive orders signed to stop the spread of COVID-19, and it appears that the data shows North Carolina has avoided a couple of those spikes that other southern states actually saw, and certainly state health officials attribute that to North Carolina's quick response in terms of shutting things down, establishing a mask mandate, and being slower to reopen things like bars and gyms. But we also hear people say it's Democratic hysteria, and you know, that's picking and choosing who can open, and it's causing other businesses to fail. What is really the right answer here? If you were in charge of the coronavirus response in North Carolina, how would you have handled it? And do you support the governor's executive orders?
That is a long intro for a question. I'll do the best I can to answer it. If you watch the governor's debate last night, you got arguments for wearing masks. You got arguments for not wearing masks. You've got scientific data that says masks are good and we should wear them. You've got scientific data that says, no, they're not. They do more harm than good. I mean, we're all over
the
witness.
The CDC has come out pretty strongly, I think, saying that mask wearing is one of the best ways to stop the spread of the virus. I mean, is there really debate on that?
Yeah, of course there is. They debated last night when the two governors.
Well, those are politicians. But in terms of the scientific community, is there debate on that?
Rachel, it just depends on who you talk to. I mean, it's just as simple as that. There are arguments on both sides. To get down to what you were asking, what I would do, I would have gone back at the beginning. I think that some of the things that the governor has done as far as trying to promote the protocols for the coronavirus are good. I wear a mask when I'm out in public. I social distance. I wash my hands. I use sanitizer. My wife makes very sure I do all of those things and keeps watch over me whenever I'm doing anything. But on the other hand, I don't think that the mass shutdown was a good thing, because I have friends that are going bankrupt. I have friends that businesses are going under. I have friends who don't have a job. I have friends who don't even know if they're going to have a job when this is over with. I wish, in a perfect world, if I'd been king that day, in a perfect world, I would have tried to come up with a plan that would have allowed to have as many businesses to remain open as there could be, to keep our economy going, to keep people working, but also making sure that the people were using the correct protocols so that we could help to prevent the spread of the disease. I would have tried to do more of a mix of the two, trying to take everybody into consideration and trying to do what would be best for everybody.
And, you know, as we look at the numbers in the state of North Carolina, the state officials say that they follow basically four metrics to make policy decisions, which include early indicators and lagging indicators, and the number of cases, the number of the percent of positive cases. It looks like we're ticking up a little bit. Are you concerned? And do you think that if we continue to tick up, we need to go backwards? Or what would you do at this point?
Well, once again, I think I would do exactly what I said that I wanted to have done in the first place. I tell you, Rachel, one of the most confusing things for me is when you hear data that supports one thing, and then you hear about data that supports another thing, and you don't know what to believe. Once again, it's all over the Richter scale. But I feel like, once again, if we can have businesses open so people can work and people don't go bankrupt, you know, they don't go out of business, they have jobs, they have income, we can keep our economy going, but at the same time, to recognize that there are protocols that need to be followed so that we can help to prevent this disease. Remember, when you wear a mask, it's not to protect me, it's to protect you. So if you're wearing a mask, you're protecting me. If I wear a mask, I'm protecting you.
Right. One of the biggest issues facing constituents in District 20, as you know, is water quality. It's been 3 years now since we discovered toxic, unregulated compounds in the drinking water supply, including Gen X. Your opponent has accused you of pandering to Chemours instead of forcing the company to make it right. How do you respond? And what's the next right step for policymakers in Raleigh on this issue?
And thank you for that question. I mean, my opponent's saying they do a lot of things. I'm the root of all evil, according to him. But to be very serious about it, as far as legislation, I got one of the first environmental legislations passed unanimously in the House that anybody can ever remember. And that was one of the bills that set up the initial funding to give DEQ money for to be able to test for contaminants in our sources of drinking water, air, groundwater, soil, and sediment. I have never done anything as an agreement with Chemours, as my opponent alleges. That is totally false. As a matter of fact, I have worked with DEQ. I've tried to get DEQ as much funding as I can. Also, I got a letter. I'm very proud of this. Michael Regan, who's the secretary of DEQ, wrote me a letter in September thanking me for my commitment to the safety of the people of North Carolina, and said, quote, "Without your vision, innovation, and leadership, we would not be the agency we are today." Now, does that sound like somebody that's not helping to work to address the safety of our citizens? Also, I asked Governor Cooper previously to shut Chemours down when this all started. Shut them down until they could absolutely guarantee us safe, that they would not be polluting our drinking water. He would not do it. I remember in the river quality meetings that I chaired, I asked DEQ, what in the world does Chemours have to do before y'all will take the tough action that needs to be taken to address this problem? Well, we'll get sued. And if we get sued, then we'll have appeals. You know, yada, yada this, yada, yada that. I said, I don't want to hear that. I want to know what can be done. I'm glad that the state lawsuit, you know, they reached a consent agreement. Didn't do a thing hardly for any of us down at the Cape Fear region. So thank goodness they did an addendum that's going to help there. But my point is, in that consent judgment, why in the world didn't you make Chemours state that they would pay for all the damages they'd done and pay for the cleanup costs? That is the place that it could have been done. It was not included. Now I see here right on the eve of the election, Josh Stein, all of a sudden and miraculously comes out on behalf of the governor and sues Chemours for damages. This should have been done a long time ago. That's what our local public utility authority did. And there's a case pending. At least they had the foresight to go ahead and sue Chemours to try to get these monetary damages paid for by them. And I might say, I've had a lot of criticism and say, well, why don't you pass a legislation that holds Chemours accountable? Rachel, the legislature cannot pass legislation that focuses on one business. It is arbitrary. It is capricious. It'll be thrown out by the court. The DEQ is our monitoring agency. It's our the enforcement agency. I mean, I'm glad we're finally coming around and doing these things, but a lot of this should have been done early. I'm sorry to go on so much, but I'm very passionate about this because we got to have clean drinking water to take care of the people who live not only in New Hanover County, but in our region as well.
This is one of the issues that caused some people to say we should repeal the Hardison Amendment, which prevents North Carolina, as I understand it, from passing laws that are more restrictive than federal laws. The EPA still has not regulated a lot of these compounds that we know are harmful to human health and also to the environment and to the fish that we consume that might be in the water. There are all kinds of implications that we don't fully understand yet. Why wouldn't that be a path that a state legislator or you could pursue?
That is a good question. Thank you for the question. The thing is, if you eliminate the Hardison Act, which means that the state or the localities, municipalities can make rules that are more harsh, you don't have a uniform system anymore. You've got Pender County could say one thing, New Hanover could say something else. Oslo could say something else. And that's the problem that I see with doing something like that. We need to act in a uniform manner, statewide, uniform regulations, so we know exactly what we have in every single county.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today, our focus is North Carolina's House District 20. Representative Ted Davis, with me now, is seeking his fifth term. You are a member of, actually, you're on the House Select Committee on Community Relations, Law Enforcement, and Justice. This is a time when we are having more conversations than ever about some of the disparities in this country and in North Carolina, and specifically in the Cape Fear region. People are tearing down Confederate monuments. What's the purpose of this committee, and is it contributing to this conversation on racial reconciliation?
I think that it is. I mean, I'll tell you, one of the biggest differences between my opponent and I is the fact that he signed a pledge to defund the police. I've signed a pledge to fund police. You got to have law and order. And you touched on that with all these things that are going down with tearing down monuments, the people breaking into cars, hurting people. I mean, this just cannot happen. We have to have order. We cannot have chaos. Excuse me. When the speaker, the Speaker of the House talked about doing this particular committee, I applauded him, because what I had done prior to him doing that, and I told him about this, I met with some of the local African-American leaders. And I said, let's just have an open dialogue. Let's talk about the rioting that's going on. Let's talk about the Confederate statues. Let's talk about education. Let's talk about job opportunities. I want to listen. I had two meetings. It was very informative. And
what did you learn? What did you learn from them that you didn't know before?
It gave me the opportunity to see what it was like to be a Black person growing up in Wilmington and trying to live in Wilmington. And it just gave me some insight about some things that I had not really thought before. And I was very pleased that I did that. I didn't make a big hoopla over it. I didn't tell the press about it. I didn't tell the radio about anybody, because I wasn't doing it to grandstand. I was doing it because I wanted to find out. And it's like one of the first things I told them, Rachel, I said, I'm just going to get it out there. None of you live in my district. None of you can vote for me. So I'm not here trying to pander to you or pander for votes. I'm here to get an honest reaction, because you say that no white people are willing to sit down and talk with you. I am here. And I really enjoyed that. And I'm really glad that I did that.
And but what will you take from that into the state legislature if you are reelected? How does that inform what you're doing?
I learned about trying to see what can be done as far as financing to allow African Americans to open businesses and do businesses, schools. I know that there is a desire for more African American teachers. Well, you've got to have them to apply first, because I've talked with the school board about that. So hopefully we can work to getting more qualified African American people to apply to be teachers in our schools, so we can get more teachers. The curriculum, talked about that, or putting more Black history in the school's curriculum. So, but the thing to get back with on that committee, after talking with the speaker about that, I'm not saying I was the genesis of it being done, but he saw a real need to do this. And I'm very proud of the fact that he formed this committee. We've been hearing from all types of different law enforcement, and different people. And I think what you will see when this is over is some good recommendations that hopefully we can implement and go forward on to try to help the present situation. I mean, we're all in this together. We've got to get along with each other.
You, on your campaign website, list four abortion-related bills that you co-sponsored, or that you sponsored, that you're very proud of. A couple of them: House Bill 602, Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, preventing, and this is what it's entitled, I think, preventing the killing of a child born after an unsuccessful abortion. A companion bill was filed in the Senate, and it passed both the Senate and the House, vetoed by Governor Roy Cooper. The veto override failed in the House. And you write quote, "I watched as the Liberal Democrats celebrated after the vote had been taken. I will mm-hmm. never forget how awful it made me feel," end quote. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to ask you about this because we know that there are seriously partisan views on the abortion and choice issue. But this bill, in fact, if a baby is born alive, whether it's during an abortion procedure or not, that baby is then a human that's covered by laws prohibiting homicide in our culture and murder. So how is that bill anything more than just political posturing? And do you believe that your Democratic colleagues want to kill babies?
Well, they must, because they voted for the bill, Rachel, and they did not vote to override the veto. So they must. And to answer your questions about, yes, there are statutes that deal with murder. You have to have malice. You have to have premeditation. No law that we presently have deals specifically with doctors or medical staff allowing a baby, an innocent baby that is born, to lie there and allow to be dead, to be killed. So, and I will tell you that when that veto override failed, I saw Deb Butler and other Democrats cheering, high-fiving. I also saw Harper Peterson, who was in our chamber when it was done, celebrating. And it was horrible. In my opinion, it was absolutely horrible. And I stand by my statements, and I stand by the fact that I think that to allow that activity to go on and kill poor, innocent babies is wrong.
Well, I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but wouldn't that baby be covered just by the fact that homicide is illegal? Once the baby is outside of the mother, then it's a living human who must be, you can't kill a baby and have that be legal. That's already on the books.
No, I disagree with you. Like I said before, you may have laws on the books that deal with murder per se. There is no law on the books that specifically deals with a doctor or medical staff allowing a baby who is born after an unsuccessful abortion to be put in a table on a room and sit there until they die. No, there's not anything that specifically deals with that.
Now, North Carolina, according to a new study, still has one of the worst teacher pay gaps. We keep hearing that things are getting bumped up a little bit each year, but we're still not at a level that allows us to be comparable, competitive with other states. Why is North Carolina still struggling with this? And does it boil down to state legislators simply caring less about public schools?
No, I don't think so at all. One of the things that I wish people would take into consideration, Rachel, when they were talking about teacher pay, is the fact that, yes, since the Republicans have taken over, we have had, I believe it's 5 or 6 consecutive teacher pay raises. It gets confusing because the governor keeps vetoing the bills and the budgets that we pass to give teachers the raises. Yet he complains about the fact, and the Democrats complain about the fact, that teachers don't get enough pay. So I guess they would rather teachers get nothing than whatever the raises that we've been trying to give them in these successive legislative budgets. I mean, it's a fact. I'm not making this up. But I also wish people would take into consideration the fact that when looking at the overall package for teachers, that the state does subsidize not only their medical care, but also their retirement. There's more to the package than just what teachers may get as far as their salary. But I mean, I have voted for every pay increase for teachers. I will continue to do that. We are trying to get there. We, you know, the little money fairy just can't come along and wave her wand, but we're trying to do the best that we can, because there are a lot of other pieces in the pie that we have to fund as well. But I take education very seriously. And matter of fact, I'm very proud that at the request of the New Hanover County Board of Education, I was able to get millions of dollars appropriated for our CTEC, which is a Southeastern Area Technical High School, which is a vocational high school, which is going to give so many students who might not be going to college that education and experience that they need so they can go out and get jobs and be a productive member of our community.
Are you any closer at this point to agreeing to expand Medicaid? because you know that's been the sticking point with the governor on passing some of these bills. So that's a thumbs up or a thumbs down, Representative Davis.
As far as Medicaid expansion, I'm not for Medicaid expansion as the way the governor wants it. We don't even have enough doctors now to cover the patients that are on Medicaid as it is.
You are listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Representative Ted Davis, candidate for North Carolina House District 20. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rachel. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment with challenger Adam Erickson. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Our focus today is North Carolina House District 20, which includes Wrightsville Beach, Landfall, Porter's Neck, Figure Eight Island, and the Holly Tree, Masonboro Loop, and Monkey Junction areas. Adam Erickson is challenging four-term incumbent Representative Ted Davis, who until this election, with its new legislative maps, represented District 19. Adam Erickson teaches and coaches lacrosse at New Hanover High School. He also volunteers for Meals on Wheels through St. Mark's Catholic Church. And he joins me now. Adam Erickson, welcome to Coastline.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
So never having run for office before, why choose a state race for your first crack at this?
Well, honestly, this year, the stakes are so huge in our history that it really didn't feel like I needed a stepping stone to get to a place. This is a historic moment in our history. There's so many things on the table. There's so much at stake that I just decided that I couldn't wait anymore and I needed to take action right now. I'm not looking for a long-term political career. I'm looking to jump into this race, make a difference in my community, and continue serving as I've been doing in various ways.
Now, of course, you list the major issues on your website, like healthcare and environment and education, but your personal message seems to hold up one galvanizing issue, public education, as the reason you jumped in the race. You say you want to go to Raleigh to fix what is not a level playing field. What would fixing the system require?
Well, as you know, education is not just a simple issue. Our public education system provides so many services to our kids and families that there's no one easy fix. There's a whole comprehensive package that needs to be looked at and worked on. I feel like, initially I got into teaching as a form of service, and I went back and got a master's degree in teaching so I could serve the high school community here. And as I was working in this system, I realized that, you know, while I could affect change with the kids in the classroom and do my best to create relationships and help them, the entire system really needs help, you know, and I thought I would jump into this and really find ways to improve the system for our kids and teachers. Many of our teachers are really suffering with low morale. They don't feel like their profession has been valued. They've been treated as professionals. And, you know, I want to make sure that they get the resources and pay that they need and that we need to attract the best people for this job. And I also found that we're woefully short in sourcing our schools. Many of our kids are still functioning in classrooms that could be decades old. And, you know, it's not just about money. It's how we prioritize what we have. How we create budgets that we reflect our values. So we're going to need a lot of things in our schools. We're going to need long-term solutions. We're going to need a comprehensive package that improves our facilities, which are about $8 billion behind where they should be. our teacher pay, which still lags behind pre-recession levels, our per pupil funding, which is in the middle or near the bottom of related to the rest of the country. So we have a lot of work to do, but I'm willing to step up and get in there in the trenches and figure out how we can use our resources to maximize where we should be going as a state and community in the 21st century.
Your opponent, longtime incumbent, 4.5 terms, has worked his way into a position of power, including being a member of the all-powerful Rules Committee, where bills go to live or die. What could you offer as a freshman, and how would you explain that it's not a disservice to the district to lose this kind of influence in the General Assembly?
Well, one of the things that my opponent is running on, Ted Davis, is that his experience is what is needed now to see us through these challenges. However, his experience has not solved any of the challenges that we're facing right now, to be quite frank. And, you know, while he is a powerful member of the House at the moment, you know, when we win the majority back, we have a whole host of fantastically talented, intelligent representatives who are more than capable of filling the job. And, you know, as a freshman, I have, you know, relationships with some existing representatives, of course, people that I know around here and have met. It's a tall order to take on political power, but it is really part of the democratic process. And I'm willing to do that as a member of this community. You know, I don't come to this with a political background. I don't come to this race with owing anybody else anything. You know, I'm just interested in working for the people of this community. Many issues have been left unfinished. You know, we lost the film industry for the most part during the last 10 years. We've discovered a seriously contaminated community with our water issues during the last few years. We've seen our education, public education system be undermined during the last 10 years. So I don't think that experience has gotten us anywhere. In addition, wages have been stagnant. You know, our working class people continue to suffer. Hundreds of thousands of people don't have healthcare. All of these things, challenges, have not been dealt with during this past 10 years, which shows me that experience is lacking.
Well, let's talk about water quality for a minute, because some people might argue that's one of the biggest issues facing District 20. The fact is, it's been 3 years since we discovered that there were potentially toxic, unregulated compounds in the drinking water supply that couldn't be removed through traditional methods. Perhaps the chemical load has lessened, but it's still there. What needs to happen, in your opinion, to solve this problem?
Well, we certainly need to work with science. You know, this is still an ongoing issue in determining what the situation actually exists now. I mean, we really don't know all of the compounds that are in the water. We're discovering new things all the time. The fact is that during the past 7 years, we have cut funding to the DEQ. We've cut 40% of the positions at the DEQ. Now, maybe those things aren't exactly related to the issue, but I can't help but think that when we cut monitoring and staffing, that we're going to have a problem discovering and fixing the problems that we see.
But isn't part of the issue with the DEQ the fact that they have no regulatory teeth, because these are compounds that they don't regulate, and the EPA doesn't even regulate? There are just health advisories. I mean, what do you do there?
That's exactly right. Well, there needs to be a process that starts developing this regulatory oversight, because that's true. I mean, we have all of these compounds which have been and may still be dumped into our drinking water, which is not replaceable. And there's no regulation on them, which is astounding to me that, and to everybody who lives here, no matter what your political persuasion, to think that there are unregulated compounds dumped in our drinking water that never go away, and we don't have any way to determine whether they're safe or not, at what levels. So we need to start developing what kind of level could be safe. Now, for me, I don't know that there's any safe level of a compound that never goes away and enters your body and stays there forever. I mean, there's no question that that's going to cause problems for people forever. But we do need to start developing a process to regulate these chemicals.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today, our focus is North Carolina's House District 20, covering part of northern New Hanover County. Challenger Adam Erickson is with me now. You say that you converted to Catholicism in 2014 and that your religion has become an important guide in your life. How would that affect your policymaking?
Well, I think the primary influence on me is the idea of service, social justice. Those things are very important to me and my family, and it really informs what I do every day when I get up and how I face the world and how I deal with people. You know, the idea that we find meaning in our life through service to others is paramount to me. I mean, there's nothing physical that I can own that can surpass the idea of helping others. And that is maybe part of the reason why I do what I do as a teacher. You know, it's just, it's something that drives me, and it'll drive the way I look at, my service in the state legislature.
Your opponent is very proud of his work, signing on to 4 abortion-related bills, including House Bill 602, which is called the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, preventing the killing of a child born after an unsuccessful abortion. And he talks about the veto override of this bill failing and how he watched the Liberal Democrats celebrate after the vote and how awful it made him feel. I asked him if he genuinely believed that Democrats are eager to murder babies. Is it accurate, first of all, that you as a Democrat would celebrate the freedom to murder newborn babies? How would you respond to that notion?
I just think that extremist talk like that does nothing to work on the actual issues that face real people. You know, that's creating scenarios and putting people on the spot for that kind of extremist talk divides people. The fact is that I support a woman's right to choose. That's the law of our land. And the vast majority of people across this country, across this state, do the same.
Does that not conflict with your faith?
Well, I mean, everybody comes, I think faith is a private matter. It's not a government matter. It's not something for me to impose on other people. You know, the freedom to practice religion as you wish is a closely held tenet of our value in our society. And I firmly believe that your religious views are your private views, and your service as a legislator requires you to follow the law and to serve all people across your community.
You say that state legislators need to make sure that our farmers stay strong and resilient and also leverage 21st century technology to protect neighboring communities from some of those farming activities. And you say downstream communities from the dangerous byproducts of large farming operations. You're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations here, CAFOs. What does need to happen? What needs to change in those operations?
Well, I think we need to make sure that we protect and promote business, agricultural business, but we also have a responsibility to protect our neighbors and the, you know, the environment that is, that belongs to all of us. And we can't, we don't need to sacrifice one to have the other. We don't just have to sacrifice environmental protections in order to have business. It won't work in the long term, you know? So, I think we can work together. I think we can have adequate protections that don't damage the agricultural owner, business person, worker, and at the same time, protect people who have nothing to do with that operation, you know.
But what needs to change? I mean, there are a number of different elements. Some of that, you know, the effluent from those CAFOs does get into nearby waterways and move downstream, and other people complain about the spraying that goes on of this effluent contaminating the air. So how would you change that? Because what you're talking about is having farmers fundamentally change the way they operate.
Well, I mean, impacting your neighbors and damaging our environment is not really an acceptable business practice. You know, that can't be an excuse to, you know, not have environmentally sound practices. So, you know, leakage from hog farms and spraying of the effluent on neighbors that gets into neighboring lands, that can't be allowed to happen. Oftentimes it's the, you know, the least well off who end up suffering the consequences of those actions. And we just have to make sure that businesses in that sector are operating with sound environmental practices and make sure that their pollution is not impacting the rest of us.
Have you learned anything in the last, say, 10 months about systemic racism or white privilege that you didn't know before, particularly as a white man? And do you think there's a need for any kind of racial reconciliation in North Carolina?
Well, I think that as a teacher in a high poverty school, a Title I school, it's certainly something that is in front of me all the time, inequities in our system. You know, there's a lot of more awareness today than ever of the bias in our system that exists, no matter who you are or where you come from. I come from a very lower socioeconomic working class family. And I thought that would connect me automatically to a lot of the kids that I serve. But despite the fact that I grew up with a single mom who cleaned houses and waited tables, my ability to do well in high school, have a great school, go to college with scholarships, go to graduate school, potentially serve in the state house of a legislature, it's just amazing. And I have opportunities that some of the kids I work with just do not have. And a lot of that has to do with the racial aspect of it. You know, it's different all over the country, of course. You know, the legacy of communities are different everywhere you come from. But I know that I have a leg up just the way, because of the way I look. You know, I will you know, have advantages that the kids I work with never have. And that makes me aware that, you know, there are things we can do perhaps to level the playing field, you know, to understand the system that we live in and how it unfairly impacts people.
Was there any particular revelation or understanding that was new for you this year?
This year in relation to...
Yeah, given to this conversation about racial reconciliation.
For this year. Well, you know, the events of this year did not just begin this year. You know, this has been a long process. This has been a long time coming. You know, the George Floyd murder was just the latest in a long string of events that have been going on for years. And even, I mean, maybe even decades, because many times these things weren't reported. So I think that it's sometimes easy for us to be complacent in our lives and say, I'm doing my little bit to help, and I've got my piece of everything, and let everybody else figure it out for themselves. But when there's a systemic issue that we are confronted with, criminal justice, social justice, and we just continue to look the other way, you know, we're failing ourselves and we're failing our society if we don't do anything about it, especially if it's the cause of systemic issues and not just, you know, some people behaving badly.
Do you think Confederate monuments should be on public grounds?
Well, I'm a history teacher. I've been studying and reading about the Civil War in our history since I was a kid. I do not feel that monuments to white supremacy and a racist system should be on public grounds. You know, I think there are places for those things, museums, other areas. But you know, in the public place where we all have to come together and live as one, I don't think that a monument to that racist past can be celebrated in a public square.
Coronavirus is, of course, political. There are critics of Governor Cooper's executive orders signed to stop the spread of COVID-19. Some have said it's hysteria. Some say it's a national democratic issue designed to slow the economy and discredit the president. North Carolina is even seeing a troubling trend upwards now, even after all of the measures taken. What would you do if you could shape policy on coronavirus in the state?
Well, of course, as a legislator, I wouldn't be dictating any kind of policy, and you know, I would be working with a lot of different people, including health experts, who would be able to offer guidance, and we can make decisions as a group. So I don't think there's one thing I'm going to do per se, other than, you know, look at the situation, the data that we're given, the evidence that we're given, and make the best decisions for this state. It's pretty clear that the way things are going now, we're just dragging our feet along and not really making the best decisions to really get rid of this virus, attack it head on, support our people, our businesses while this is going on, and then come out of it together.
By supporting businesses, are you saying financial support from the government, or are you saying allow them to be open?
Oh, I think that we need to have more support, grants, small business loans, things like that. I think as soon as people start getting together, the virus spreads. We're already seeing it in our schools as people come back together, and it's inevitable. Nobody wants businesses to be closed. We love restaurants. We love, entertainment. We've missed it greatly. We have friends who are struggling mightily and in those businesses, and we'd love to have them back open. But if they're open, full out open, we're going to have a lot more sickness and death. And the number one job of government is public safety, and we have to protect that.
And is there any role that state legislators play in addressing climate change in North Carolina?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in a coastal community, we're going to have to start thinking about long-term infrastructure, especially along the coastline. We have a lot of coastal communities, and the sea levels are rising. There's no doubt about that. We're having a lot more storms, a lot worse storms. We have a lot more damage to deal with, infrastructure issues. There's a whole host of things. We may have to deal with changes in agricultural policies. So there's a whole host of things that we'll need to address in terms of climate change.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Adam Erickson, Democratic challenger for North Carolina House District 20. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure being here. And thank you for what your program does for this community. It's a great service.
Thank you. Thanks also to Republican Representative Ted Davis Jr. One-stop voting is underway and runs through October 31st. North Carolina voters can request absentee ballots until October 27th. Election day is November 3rd. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered today's show. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.